Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel alone, singing a song side by side.
Aloha, and welcome to Makai Watch, a program about the aina, those things that feed us. My name is Maka'ala, and I thank KKCR General Manager Laura for engineering for me today. This program is about Makai, toward the ocean. And today, I want to remind us all that one of the key connectors, our native connector between the land and the sea, is taking its very first flight from its burrow in the mountains to the ocean where its food lives. And that is our precious native Newell Shearwater birds. So they start this week, folks. They're fledging. They're flying for the very first time. Please don't let your lights be the reason they come to the ground. Please don't yet let your lights be the reason that predator cats have them for dinner. So let's all pay attention to our exterior lights. And this also means the lights that you have inside your living room or inside your kitchen that emanate light out if you're living near the coast. They see that as the moon, and they're looking for the moon. And if they don't see the moon, but they see your light becomes their moon. So we can do our part, so please help protect our native seabirds. We begin today, as we have been since maybe February, by expressing our hope that you and your ohana are well and safe and at home. These are difficult times, and we're all learning how to adjust and adapt, practicing new behaviors. People seem to me to be getting pretty good at it. I do see certain places where masks are not as prevalent, but I got to say, pretty much for the North Shore, people are being fairly compliant. Not too many folks without masks, and all of the establishments are requiring them. So, you know, keep a couple extra in your car. And for those of us that have these wonderful cloth masks, please be sure to wash them. They don't stay clean on their own. We want to also particularly thank our mayor and his administration for their leadership and assertive actions to assure that we all have a fighting chance to protect our Kauai Ohana. I know that some of the rules made our lives a little bit more cumbersome, a little bit more difficult, but he's saving lives, and he deserves our support while he does it. Today, we have a special guest that is calling in from Oahu. You all know that flying between Kauai and Oahu is not as much fun as it once was. I guess the flying's as fun, but the landing's not as much fun, because then you got to go into quarantine. So Dr. Alan Friedlander is stationed on Oahu. He gets around a lot, as you will hear. But we thank him for calling in today. He's the chief scientist for the National Geographic Pristine Seas and a researcher at the University of Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Aloha, Alan. Are you on the line?
I am. Aloha. Good to hear from you, Maka'ala.
Good to hear from you, too. Thanks so much for doing this. I know that you're a busy guy, but I really appreciate you spending some time with us today. We have a long history with you on the North Shore of Kauai. We're very proud of our partnership, and we'll get to that in a little while, but I'd like to start giving you a chance to sort of introduce yourself and who you are and where you came from. People always want to know, who is that guy, where'd he come from, and how in the world did he get to Kauai? So give us a little bit of that, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Yeah, we got a lot of long backstories, right? We've been knowing each other for about 30 years. So I am originally from the East Coast, from Maryland. Grew up around Chesapeake Bay, fishing and crabbing and so forth. My first time to Hawaii was actually 1982 on my way to Tonga. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Tonga working on fisheries issues. So I stopped on the way to Hawaii and was on the North Shore during Hurricane Eva back then. Another hurricane story coming up after that one that we can talk about. But and Hawaii was the first place I visited on the way back after being out in the U.S. for 3+ years. So had a little bit of history there. But basically, when I came back from Tonga, where I had worked real closely with the community and local fishermen, I got a master's in oceanography and then worked in the Caribbean for about 4 or 5 years, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And at that point, I realized that, there were a lot of people working on coral reef ecology, coral reefs, fisheries, but nobody was really looking at fisheries, you know, how important these coral reef fisheries are to people throughout the world, Hawaii, throughout the Pacific. And so I decided to come back for a PhD, and I got in touch with Jim Parrish at the Hawaii Cooperative Fisheries Research Unit at UH. So I came back to Hawaii in 1990, and I've basically been here ever since. When I showed up in Hawaii, Jim told me that they had this project up in Hanalei, and that he asked me if I'd lead it. So I said, that sounds great. So I packed up everything. And starting in 1991, I moved up to Hanalei, lived there for about 4 years. And it was an amazing time. That's where I met you and learned a lot about the bay. I calculated over 1,000 hours underwater during that 4 year stint up in Hanalei. And worked every month of the year up in that place, which you all know is not the most fun in the winter months, but a lot of stories to tell relative to that one. But, you know, I'm really proud of the fact that I've got so much support from you and everybody in the community during when we were up there. But also, it's the longest-running extant monitoring program in the state for coral reefs going back to 1991. And so that last 28 years doing that, we've kind of done it on a shoestring with help from you and a lot of other people. And I think it's really been a worthwhile thing. I've learned a ton about Hanalei and been really, I think, you know, really at the forefront of coral reef science in Hawaii and elsewhere.
Yeah, yes, thank you for that. So I'll just add a little piece of Alan was working in Hanalei, as he said, when Iniki hit. And our experiences in the village of Hanalei in those days was that people that weren't from there skedaddled. You know, there was too much work to do. There wasn't, you know, utilities. It was not a fun place to be. And so they all vamoosed. And Alan didn't leave. Alan stayed. And we noticed. And the people in Hanalei go, whoa, how come he's still here? You know, what's he doing here? And Alan pitched in, and he had a lot of friends at that point, made a lot more by staying, and established a relationship of trust. And became somebody that the people could see what really cared about them as well, cared about the community, not just about the fish and not just about your research, but really wanted to talk to people. And a lot of what Alan was doing was talking to fishermen and so forth. And it takes time, as we all know, to establish any kind of a relationship with fishermen. And the key to it, in my world anyway, is time. You prove to them that you're not just, you know, a one-hit show, and they'll help you out with your work a whole lot more. One of the things Alan did was a creel study, K-R-E-E-L, which we have had a very hard time repeating, because Alan's technique was to sit up on top of the hill where the Princeville Hotel is and look down over the bay, and he would see a fisherman catch something, and then he would zoom down the hill into Hanalei and walk out to the beach and go, you know, Hanapa, what'd you get? And the guy say, oh, no more nothing. And I'll say, I just saw you. I was standing up there. I saw, you know, let me see. And after they stopped laughing, and, oh, okay, you know. So he actually got the information. He got the data, what had in the cooler. We have tried a variety of techniques since then. Never been quite as successful. But it was good data for the time. And someday, Alan, we're going to get it back again. But I'm searching for the right strategy. But thanks for doing all of that work, and it mattered. You know, it was a good baseline. Nobody had done the work before, and nobody knew. One of the things
it's a great project. If some kids want to get involved in it now, I'd be more than happy to help. It was really valuable at the time. It still sticks out as being one of the best studied fisheries probably in the state. So we know a lot about Hanalei, but that was a long time ago, so it definitely be worth going and repeating that. There's a lot of knowledge to be gained.
I've tried pretty young girls. I've tried brown-skinned people from other places. I've tried old folks. I've tried a variety. Yeah, yes, if your youth are looking for a project, We need to repeat that Creole study. We need it because we have the baseline. We need the new data. There's no, it's not about rules or punishment or any, it's just basic information. We just need the data. And you know, if you let us gut and weigh and gut the fish and do the gonad study, we'll clean your fish. You know, we've often said that, and that doesn't even seem to introduce. But anyway, so yes, we should work on that, huh, Alan? When you started out, and you decided that you wanted to study coral reefs, did you know that in high school?
Yeah, I mean, I was always had an affinity for the bay, you know, Chesapeake Bay, where I grew up, and then, you know, surfing on the East Coast, living in California for a while. But, yeah, I mean, I always had an affinity towards the ocean and marine science. Everybody watched Jacques Cousteau growing up, but I also liked Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges. I thought he was a lot cooler because he got into fights underwater and kind of interesting stuff. So
he was a cool guy.
Everybody, you know, liked Jacques Cousteau. But so that was, yeah, a big impetus for me. But I tell you, you know, I was living in San Diego at the time and going to graduate school at Scripps, and was walking through the halls, and on the bulletin board it said fisheries jobs in the Peace Corps. And I just assumed the Peace Corps just taught math and science and English and didn't realize that they did more technical things. And so when I saw that, I was like, wow, that sounds awesome. So I applied. Took a long time to apply on the whole process. They originally wanted to send me to Zaire in Africa, which is now Congo, but I waited, and then the offer came up for Tonga, and it was just an amazing experience. I lived on a small outer island, no roads, no electricity, no running water, worked with fishermen all the time. I learned how much, you know, a healthy ocean, what it meant to them, but also just the knowledge that they had of the resources was kind of encyclopedic. It was pretty amazing. And I kind of followed that through my career, all the work I've done in Hawaii with communities and elsewhere. It amazes me how much knowledge exists within places that people can use to better manage and, you know, sustain their resources. So the whole thing in Tonga was, you know, pretty influential for me, kind of moving my career forward.
Yeah, you know, I'm grateful for that story because we sometimes have a clue early on what we want to do, and sometimes, you know, the universe just conspires and we get sort of directed into a field. But to make those community connections, that seems to me to be your common denominator, is being able to make the connection with the people and the fisher part of the story later, you know. So, yeah, good stuff.
The fish don't do any good unless people can eat them, and they can eat them for a long time to come. So, yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, it's all about that, and the fish are just kind of the glue that holds the communities together. So it's really important. In a sense, in saving the fish, if you're not going to save the people.
Yeah, no kidding. So one of the things, one of your fancy titles is Chief Scientist for the National Geographic Pristine Seas. What's a pristine sea?
Well, pristine sea is a bit of a misnomer because the world is very small, and, you know, no place is untouched by people. But that said, our Pristine Seas project started a little over a decade ago, and it's about saving the last wild places in the ocean. And we do that through a combination of exploration, science, compelling media, which Nat Geo does an amazing job of, and policy. So while even the most remote places on the planet have had people at some point in time, they're still relatively wild. So, you know, pristine seas is a nice catchy phrase, but we have to be aware that, you know, even places in the middle of nowhere, I've seen sharks with fish hooks in their mouth. But that said, these places are incredibly inspiring to me. Over the last decade plus, we've had 30 expeditions. We've protected 22 areas, 6 million square kilometers of some of the last wild places in the ocean, from the Arctic to the Antarctic and everywhere in between, kelp forests, coral reefs. And these places are inspiring because you get to go to places where no one's ever been before, and you just get blown away when you jump in the water and you see, you know, 100 sharks or a polar bear that chases you out of water. But, you know, these experiences they give you hope. They give you hope that, you know, all the wheels aren't coming off. These are places that are intact, that are incredibly healthy. And we even have examples of that in Hawaii, right? Papa and Elmo Kokea, where I worked extensively in the late 90s and early 2000s to help get it protected, is an amazing place. But even in the main Hawaiian Islands, we've got places that look really good. You know, we just finished an extensive study of all the research that's been done over in Hawaii over the last decade or so. And places like Koholawe, the Hamakua coast on the Big Island, North Shore Molokai, Niihau, you know, some of these places look amazing. So even in our own backyard, we still have hope. So it's easy to see places around Oahu and, you know, south and west Maui that kind of look like train wrecks. But I think we need to look at both ends of the spectrum and see where we fit, and that helps us kind of guide where we want to go.
So you go on all these excursions. You go to all these places, and I know that some of them are pretty fascinating locations and not places that we ordinarily think of as places that require some exploration. So for Pristine Seas, you go, you look at these places, you document them, and then are they all, is this like international waters or like that? So that there's, is there a government that you say, okay, you've got a really healthy place here, you need to put some rules in place to keep it that way? Or is this all multinational stuff or combination? Or, I mean, I would think that if I was going to go and see something that was absolutely amazingly healthy, I would want to tell somebody, okay, now this is really cool, leave that alone.
Right. It's a double-edged sword of, you know, finding these places that are amazing, trying to get them protected, but not, you know, putting neon signs and highlighting it to the distant water fishing fleets, which seem to be everywhere. But to answer the first part of that, it's mainly in national waters, but they are remote places, and most but not all are places that don't have people. I'll get into the people stuff in a second. But so these places are remote. The southern Hawaiian Islands of Tiribas, you know, 1,500 miles south of Hawaii. South of Christmas Island, there's five islands, Malden, Starbucks, Flint, Vostok, and Millennium, which used to be Caroline. Nobody's there. They're amazing. You jump in the water, you know, 70, 80, 90% coral cover, hundreds of sharks. And, you know, other places, Rapa Iti or Sally Gomez near Rapa Nui, but uninhabited as well. So what we do is we go to these last wild places. We only go under the invitation of the national government. So we don't just parachute in and say, we're here to help. we always work. And National Geographic opens up a lot of doors. So you're able to work at the highest levels of government. And that's really important. Because if, you know, if they, you know, feel like they're doing good, doing the right thing, they will. And so we work with, you know, ministers, heads of state. We do these expeditions. It's amazing exploration because in a lot of times no one's ever been there before. We collect really rigorous science. We throw a lot of things at it. We have submersibles, deep sea cameras. We do scuba dives, deep sea rebreather diving, all kinds of stuff. Just because collecting data in these places hadn't really been done. And then we have this compelling media component because of National Geographic. And these guys, they produce amazing content. So it's not just films for the channel, but we tailor our media to heads of state, to politicians, to policymakers, to stakeholders. And that, you know, that just inspires people. People get blown away. Sometimes, like, we were in Niue, you know, a small island near Tonga in the South Pacific, 1,500 people in the whole country. There's a remote island 10 hours away called Beveridge Reef that's uninhabited. People in Niue had no idea what that looked like. They'd never seen it before. And it's amazing. It's like Papa and Elmo Kokea. Most of us don't get the chance to go up there. But when you see what these places look like, it's pretty incredible. So we combine all those elements together, and then we work towards policy decisions that, like you said, help protect these places because they, you know, because they aren't usually influenced by local human populations. They are, they're, you know, you can get protection in place. So even though they're remote, We work with satellite companies. There's a lot of things in place now that make the world easier to monitor. Remote surveillance of remote places has become more tractable and cost-effective. There's international policies that prohibited boats from landing in other ports if they've been found to be bad actors. It's called the Port States Measure. So that's really effective. You know, if you're found to do something bad in some place, you can be denied access to another port. And so there are mechanisms, because people say, wow, these places are really remote. They're out of the way. How can you protect them? But we recognize the challenges, but it's getting better with technology. Now, some places we work, like in Palau or in West Africa, where there are people, it's been a different approach where we've kind of tried to work and support local efforts for local conservation. And you can do that with media, but also with good science and training and outreach. So it really depends on the situation.
It seems to me that for some of these places that are remote now but haven't been fished, as we overfish other areas, they are also at risk for fishing pressure that they might not have been up to now. And so to hold those places, to study them and record, then report on them to the surrounding population, whatever that is, whether it's government or community, and say, this is what's happening right there. It's within your so-called neighborhood. And these are the things that we saw, and this is the nursery for your fishery. This is the place that you need to help us protect for the future of your fishery. Because one of the threats is, you know, and I sometimes think this when I watch National Geographic, and I'm so glad I can, you know, be the armchair explorer, because I thoroughly enjoy that. But for some, it's going to, whoa, I want to go there. Whoa, I want to see that, you know, because you're showing us things that we can't otherwise see or wouldn't otherwise know about. So you're, in a way, you're kind of exposing them too, right?
That is true, and it's a worry. You know, ecotourism has, like I said, you know, goods and bad sides to it. It can, if it's done properly and effectively, it can benefit the communities and provide revenue, but, you know, mass market tourism, as we know in Hawaii, has done no favors to the local economy nor the local ecology. So you got to be careful about that. There's places like Raja Ampat in Indonesia, biodiversity hotspot, where groups have worked with local communities, and there's been economic benefits from tourism. But, and, you know, most of the distant water fishing fleets know where these places are. These aren't news. There's tens of thousands of these boats out there. It's kind of amazing. China, Taiwan, Korea, they're the biggest culprits of what we call the dark fleet. These are these boats that really barely float. They've already made their money several times over, so they go to sea, they get refueled. They transship, which means they offload their catch to motherships, and they often never reach port again. There's big problems with slave labor, you know, human trafficking. Basically, if you're doing one thing illegal, you're doing multiple things. So arms running, drug trafficking, all these things happen when you're doing these. So we've been trying to work with national governments to make these national security issues. We work with the U.S. Navy, U.S. Coast Guard, Australian Navy, other countries, to try to recognize the fact that these incursions by foreign actors is more than just illegal fishing. There's a lot of other issues at stake. So that also helps in the enforcement of these remote areas.
So are you in harm's way sometimes when you're out there if they think you've spotted them?
Well, I have been shot at, only once. That was on the north. That was a miscommunication there.
A failure to communicate.
Of Gabon in West Africa, there's a small military base. Not even a base. It's a little island with a couple guys. And
but one of them had a gun.
Well, they did. It was contested between them and Equatorial Guinea, and we showed up on this little boat. And, in fact, the president of Gabon was on the main ship at the time.
Oh, dear.
But these guys did obviously not get the memo, probably because they had no electricity. But yeah, we jumped in the water and they started shooting at our boat. Once we got on the radio, and I just figured it'd be safer in the underwater than on the boat, so I jumped in the water. So that was a prudent thing to do. They got on the radio. We figured it out. By the end of the day, we ended up playing soccer with the guys on the beach, so all was well.
All was well.
But, yeah, I mean, fortunately, there's been a couple instances. Once in Salligomez Island, which is a couple days' sail east of Rapa Nui of Easter Island, and we did see some boats there. Fortunately, we were on a Chilean naval vessel, so that was an easy one. The guys just went over and dealt with it. So we had good cooperation with navies from a number of countries, particularly Chile. We did an expedition with them to Antarctica last year, and that was super fun. Our first trip with the Chilean Navy was a bit of a cultural experience for everybody, not the Latin thing. It's just that military culture is very different than science culture and media culture. So we had a bit of a dating process that took place. But they've been excellent partners since then. And Chile has been an amazing country as far as marine conservation goes. They went from almost having none of their waters protected to having almost 40% of their waters now under some type of conservation. And they've been great. And it's been super good collaboration with them. We really enjoyed all of it. Went to places like Robinson Crusoe Island, which is 500 miles off the coast, where the story about Robinson Crusoe is actually written. He was a Scottish seaman and got stuck on the island for 4 years by his choosing. Came back, and Daniel Defoe, the author in the 1700s, novelized his experience there. So it's actually a true story.
Hmm. Fascinating. How is all this paid for? Is this all donations to National Geographic, or do nations also contribute to the effort?
Our Pristine Seas Project has been pretty autonomous. And Leif Sala, who's the executive director of Pristine Seas and explorer in resident at National Geographic, has been really charismatic and been a great leader in envisioning this project. And Leif used to be a professor at Scripps when I first met him. And we worked together in the Northern Line Islands. And he said he got tired of writing the obituaries of science and conservation and left Scripps and took this job with National Geographic. And he built this program from scratch. When we first started, I was a professor at UH. We were all kind of doing this on a shoestring. And Reek was really good at raising money. And success breeds success. We've been incredibly successful. We've gotten a lot of great protection, good media, a lot of scientific publications out of this work, and more people are willing to support that. And now National Geographic does support our efforts, and so we've been pretty fortunate over the last couple of years that we haven't had to raise as much money as we did in the first portion of the project. But been a lot of hard work, people are, the amount of money that goes towards conservation, particularly marine conservation, is very, very small compared to what we see for public health and a lot of other issues that people deem rightly so or not so, more important. So it's difficult to sell the importance of the ocean. I mean, in Hawaii, we all get it, right? We all live by the ocean. We understand the ocean and realize how important it is for culture and subsistence and recreation and everything else. In a lot of places, they don't get it, but it affects everybody. Half of all the oxygen we breathe comes from the ocean. Provides livelihoods for tens of millions of people. It's biodiversity hotspot. There's so many things that we don't know about the ocean yet. It covers most of the planet, right? And it's a hard sell, but we have been, really successful over the last decade, and I just feel fortunate that I've gotten to see these places because they do inspire you. They let you know how far we've shifted. The shifting baseline is kind of a systemic problem we have as humans. Each subsequent generation has lower and lower expectation of what's quote unquote natural. And so having these baselines like Papanamokokea and other places helps us gauge, how we're doing in other places. I mean, Kauai and the North Shore Kauai are fortunate in the sense that you know, human population is relatively low. The resources are still see the good and the bad within our own state, and that really helps us figure out, you know, where we should go.
Yeah, we're gonna take a bit of a break here. Sometimes your voice is fading just a little bit in and out. I'm not sure what's doing it, but we're gonna take a little bit of a break. We're talking with Dr. Alan Friedlander, who's I just don't know. I guess I'm just going to say a marine biologist, but he loves Kauai, and Kauai loves Alan. So we're going to take a little bit of a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about specifically the Kauai work. And if you have a question or you want to ask Alan something or tell Alan something, 826-7771. We'll be right back. We're going to take a little break.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog. He was a good friend of mine. Never understood a single word he said, but I helped him drink his wine. And he always had some mighty fine wine. Singing joy to the world now. All the boys and girls now. Joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea. Joy to you and me. Everybody singing joy to the world now. All the boys and girls now. Joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea. Joy to you and me. If I were the king of the world, tell you what I'd do. Throw away the cars and the bars and the wars, and make sweet love to you. Just make sweet love to you.
It'll be all right. Before we go back to our conversation with Alan Friedlander, we do have a current announcement from our favorite mayor, Derek Kawakami, and Laura is going to play that for us now.
Aloha, Kauai. Here's our COVID-19 briefing from Team Kauai for Monday, September 14th. The Department of Health reported no new cases. We currently have 5 individuals in quarantine on Kauai due to their contact with a current Oahu case. Our cumulative case count is 58. For additional information, please visit the Kauai Emergency Management Agency website at www.kauai.gov/COVID-19. We expect Governor Ige to approve our Mayor's Emergency Rule 16 today, which is Kauai's proposal for an enhanced movement quarantine program, more popularly known as resort bubbles. Because the virus continues to threaten our communities, we don't know when the mandatory quarantine can be lifted. As we've learned, this virus does not follow specific dates in the calendar, so we have to be ready to adapt and adjust. At the same time, we understand the need to address the economic hardship facing our tourism-based community while also preserving the safety of our residents. The resort bubble is not the final solution, but a tool that we hope will allow visitors to experience our island while protecting our community. Here's how it works. Under the current quarantine, visitors cannot leave their hotel room for 14 days, but under the resort bubble concept, the resort property will have safety policies in place to help protect both employees and guests, which would allow quarantine guests to utilize the entire resort property, including the pool and on-site restaurants. All employees and guests on property will be subject to all rules and guidelines in place, such as wearing masks and practicing physical distancing. Also, in order for a visitor to stay at an enhanced movement quarantine resort, they must agree to wear an electronic bracelet that helps hotel management ensure guests stay on the resort property. The bracelet, which looks similar to a smartwatch, utilizes a technology called geofencing so that their movement can be monitored. If at any point a guest should leave the hotel property and break quarantine, it will be immediately flagged by hotel security and police will respond. There will also be consequences for anyone who tampers with a bracelet. The resort bubble program is a voluntary program. It is voluntary for hotels to participate, and it is voluntary for visitors to stay there. It's intended to be an added tool, not a replacement, and we are still supportive of the mandatory quarantine program and the state's proposed pre-travel testing program. We also understand that this is a calculated risk, and we are committed to working with participating hotels and our health officials to mitigate that risk as best as we're able. We do not yet have a date on when a resort bubble might open, but several hotels have expressed interest and we're working toward a more concrete plan. We will continue to keep our community updated as we make progress. We continue to recommend that you not travel unless absolutely necessary. But if you must travel, know that all travelers must complete the state's new online Safe Travels digital travel form, which can be found online at travel.hawaii.gov. In addition to the state form, all incoming travelers to Kauai must also complete a Kauai arrival form, which you will receive when you land. It will be collected and reviewed at baggage claim prior to the leaving the airport facility. As a reminder, all incoming travelers, residents, and visitors must enter a 14-day quarantine. Critical infrastructure employees who fly to Kauai for work must quarantine at a hotel or motel. These workers are prohibited from staying in a private home or TVR during their quarantine period. For details, please visit www.kauai.gov/COVID-19. If you're flying in from the mainland and believe you're eligible for a modified quarantine, please email covidexemption@hawaii.gov. If you're traveling inner island and believe you qualify for a modified quarantine, you can submit an application online by visiting www.kauai.gov/COVID-19 and click on the modified quarantine request button at the top of the page. Time is running out to complete the U.S. Census, but it is extremely important to our future. Much federal money, including school lunch money, education funds, food stamp assistance, is allocated by population. Every island, every county, every state is fighting for federal dollars. And if we're undercounted, money that should be going to us is going somewhere else. Please take a few minutes out of your day, fill out this census form, and be counted. The clock is ticking, and the time to stand up to be counted and get our fair share is now. Visit my2020census.gov and file your report. For those who have not completed your census online, a census worker will be visiting your home to assist you in completing your census form. As a reminder, renters whose income is reduced due to COVID-19 and who may be at risk of eviction are encouraged to apply for the new State Rent Relief and Housing Assistance Program. The program is funded by the Federal CARES Act. It is being administered by Catholic Charities Hawaii and Aloha United Way. It can help with housing payments due between August 1st and December 28, 2020. Payments are made directly to the landlord for up to $1,500 for Kauai residents. For information on the program or to apply, please visit www.hihousinghelp.com. We thank you for being responsible when you leave your home and engage with others. We each have a role to play in mitigating the spread of COVID-19 on our island. That means stay home as much as possible. Refrain from social gatherings or public outings. If you must interact with people outside of your home, maintain a distance of 6 feet of separation and wear a mask, if at all possible for you to do so. Remember, my mask protects you and your mask protects me. It's a sign of respect and aloha. Do not leave home if you are sick unless you're seeking medical attention, and then only after calling your doctor first. Wash your hands frequently and clean surfaces often. Stay informed and connected during this time of social distancing. We'll continue to post updates on our official County of Kauai Facebook page or on our Kauai Emergency Management Agency page at www.kauai.gov/COVID-19. The Centers for Disease Control is also updating its website regularly. For more information, please visit coronavirus.gov. Not everyone has internet access or follows the news, so please help to keep your loved ones informed. Be kind, take care of one another, God bless, and aloha.
Mahalo, Derek Kawakami. We're so proud of our mayor, and I thank you, Alan, for allowing us to take up some of your time with that announcement. It was a little longer than we expected, but there you go. He's been a shining star, and we appreciate him and his administration very, very much. They're responsive, and they get us. They get us. They understand. And he likes to surf in Hanalei. I don't know how much time he actually spends under the water, because I think he's a pretty good surfer, so that means he's on top of the water. But we're talking with Alan Friedlander, who's done some amazing research worldwide, all over the globe, but now I'd like to focus a little bit on why we know him so well, because of the work that he's done on Kauai and in Hanalei specifically. So in Hanalei, you started in 91, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's a long time ago. So in the years since, you have been looking at the same parts of Hanalei as often as you can, often annually with a few gaps here and there. And you and a buddy of yours, Dr. Eric Brown, who looks at the coral specifically, have over the years produced some pretty interesting reports about the condition of Hanalei. And I'd like you to spend just a minute just talking about, you know, what is the condition of the Hanalei reef ecosystem at this point. And you haven't been here in a while now because you can't do the travel bit, but you'll be here as soon as you can, I know.
Right. So first off, I moved locations. I don't know if you can hear me better.
Yes,
now.
We can. We can.
Good. Great. So Dr. Eric Brown, he's my partner in crime. He's a guy who I worked with extensively throughout the state. Used to be in Kalapapa, now in Samoa. We have worked together throughout Hawaii, but he's really stuck with me on the Hanalei project because we've really been self-financing it and, you know, with the support of you, Maka'ala, and others, and been able to make this work. So starting in 91, we really did a comprehensive study of the entire bay over a four-year period. And then since then, I've been trying to come back on a regular basis, surveying the same 20-some sites for fish and coral and limu and other things. And so kind of have a good picture of what's going on. Now, yeah, we missed this year because of COVID, although we are ready to come. We missed last year because of the flood. We made it the previous year. And the take-home I get from Hanalei is an incredibly dynamic environment. So this is a place where nature trumps people for the most part. And so, you know, the drainage for the wettest spot on Earth, it gets giant surf in the winter months. And so there's a lot of things going on there, and we see the community changing a lot. Right now, the coral cover really took a beating with the previous flood, you know, when a couple years ago, not this last one, but the one just before then. And so I'm kind of optimistic about Hanalei because I've seen it bounce back so many times over the last almost 30 years. And so the fish change, the corals change, and things like that. There's obviously some places that are more impacted by others, places that are associated with the Hanalei River, with Waipa, with Waikolu, some of its stream mouths, probably suffer from some of the land-based pollution, also from, you know, poor land management in some of those places. But for the most part, Hanalei bounces back. So that's kind of been my take home, and I'm really looking forward to coming back again and see how it's doing after this last couple bouts of pretty significant events.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that you've taught me that I have repeated in the work that I do is that, you know, Hanalei is a pretty tough place to live. It's a tough place to survive. And the coral cover that exists there and the corals that survive there, they're kind of tough corals. They're specifically designed as the survivors of the rough waters, etc. So when your research in Hanalei consists of the installation of, I think it's 21, is that the right number? 22. Stainless steel pins. And the miracle of all miracles, folks, is that when Alan and Eric come, they find these pins again and again and again. And the pins don't move, but, you know, conditions change and, you know, it's hard to remember where was that. Nope, they pretty much find them all. So they have permanent markers. So when they're looking at a place and how it's changed and over time, they're looking at exactly the same places. So the data is very, very useful that way. If you could describe, I've heard you describe the fishery of Hanalei as diverse, maybe not all the kinds of fish that we would like to see on our dinner plate, but diverse. And that means it includes the roi and the ta'ape and the to'au, correct?
Right, yeah. So the roi kind of, well, ta'ape were really prevalent back in the 90s, and they seem to have waned a little bit in their overall abundance.
That's
there were some guys who fished for them pretty hard. I mean, so ta'ape and to'au are perfectly good eating fish. You know, they're non-native. Obviously, they were brought in from French Polynesia back in the 50s. Probably not the greatest idea in the world, but you know, they're doing okay. The to'au is more estuary. So you see them in the Muliwai, you see them, you know, in the Hanalei River more, but when you have big discharge events, you see them out more on the reef. The ta'ape are more, you know, out by Pu'apu'a and other places in deeper water with the beke. They're perfectly good eating fish. Roi, so the problem with roi are they're cyclotoxic, right? They have fish poison in them, so not the greatest of fish to introduce. They are a predator, so they can be an issue, but, you know, it wouldn't hurt for people to remove them off the reef, but I don't think it's the major problem facing Hanalei's reefs. A lot of people like to point finger at the introduced fish. It wasn't a great idea when they did it, but we've got other problems.
Yeah, as we work, we're getting ready in Hanalei to do some extensive watershed flood mitigation projects. And I'm hoping that we will see some positive impacts from that work on the fishery. I'm hoping, for example, that it will reduce sediment, which can't hurt. And I'm hoping that it will certainly improve the water quality overall. That's not the purpose of the project, but it may indeed be one of the good outcomes of it. And so I'm sure hoping that you and Eric get in the water. You generally come in May and September or October, and the reason for that is that's when the corals spawn, and Eric does his coral larval settlement plates, which is great fun, folks. So they install these ceramic plates on these stainless steel pins, and the corals spawn. Oops. Was that you or me?
Sorry, I got cut off.
Oh, okay. Are you back? Oh, you're back now? Okay.
I am, yeah.
Okay. All I heard was a siren, and I thought, uh-oh. They're coming to get
me. No, that was just a coincidence.
Yeah, between you and me, we're never sure whether that's a coincidence or not, Alan. So, okay, thanks.
Right. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed is right. Okay, so he installs these ceramic plates. The corals spawn, and the baby coral, the coral larvae, settle on the plates, and then they come back and collect them again, and Eric takes them to his lab and does some sort of, you know, hocus-pocus magic stuff and is able to...
He painstakingly looks under a microscope and counts them all.
Counts every single one. I don't know.
I love Eric.
We all love Eric. We don't know how he does it. And we have that data over... That's awesome.
That's an amazing story. So, like Maka'ala was saying... you don't see these delicate corals in Hanalei. It's these encrusting, robust species that really thrive there. But it has some of the what we call recruitment. So when the keiki come back and settle out, some of the highest recruitment we see anywhere is in Hanalei Bay. So corals like rice coral, some of the other ones, they typically spawn around June. So we put the settlement plates out in May. Now we come pick them up in September after the spat have settled out, and then Eric goes and counts them. We see some of the highest recruitment of settlement of corals in Hanalei statewide, but also globally. And it's an interesting thing because Hanalei is one of the few bays, if any, on the North Shore. So the corals kind of tend to stay put within the bay. So even though, you know, coral larvae drift around for about a week. But they all, you know, a lot of them seem to settle back in Hanalei, which is kind of amazing. So that's a great story. We're always getting keiki coming back in to help replenish the coral community. That's a good thing. The downside of that is climate change. Before, we used to get a lot of rain. You know, our big storm events are typically been in the winter time, sometimes in the spring. But now you see more big rain events in the summer months. And that is bad because it disrupts the settlement for the coral larvae and things like that. So those are things that we need to think about. There's not much we can do about it at the local level, but be aware that, you know, things beyond our control are influencing the coral reef communities in Hanalei itself.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary thing, and it's another one of those things that I want the Kauai people to be proud of. You know, I mean, it's a bit of an odd story. People don't appreciate it. They hear a lot of fake news about, you know, what's happening there and what's not happening there. But the fact is that it's an extraordinarily robust coral ecosystem. And we should all be grateful because come hurricane and storm surge and tsunami and all that, those corals play a critical role in protecting us folks. So we're going to wind it up, and thank you so much, Alan, for spending this time with us. I know it goes by fast, and of course, our sweet mayor took up a chunk today, and I apologize for that. So, would you?
Yeah, I'm sure it was important.
Yeah, it was. So, if you you wanted any parting thoughts or any last things that I forgot to ask you about or anything else, I know you're waiting to come.
Beyond the scope, I really, you know, applaud the community efforts in Hanalei and Haena to move forward with, you know, taking stewardship over the local resources, because that's the way it was, and that's really the way that it needs to be. And so I'm looking forward to coming back to Hanalei and working with everyone as soon as possible.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Alan played a very key role in the community subsistence fishing area process for Haena and is working hard for Molokai and helping Hanalei for all these years. We thank you very much, and we hope to get to see our friend Eric Brown soon. He is now in American Samoa and a little bit further away than he used to be. But we're hoping to see you in Hanalei very soon. And thank you, Alan. I appreciate your time today.
Mahalo, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay. Aloha.